3D printing today, show number 554, deep mesh watermarking, annealing HT PLA, tariffs anyone?
Welcome back to 3D Printing Today, the podcast about all aspects of 3D printing. Hobby, professional, industrial, it doesn't matter what kind of 3D printing, we cover it all. My name's Andy Cohen, and I'm here with Mr. Whitney Powder.
How are you doing, Andy?
I'm doing pretty good. So we were going to talk about something else, but news kind of overtook it.
Right.
And we're not even sure if this is real or not. I'm sure all of you out there have heard the big news story, unfortunate, horrific news story, about the murder in Manhattan, New York City, of the CEO of United Health, and the capture of his alleged killer. It looks pretty strong that the guy they got is the killer. And they found his knapsack in Central Park, and they say they've got a gun, and an unsubstantiated, unverified, they're saying it was a 3D printed ghost gun.
Right. Now, we should point out that 3D printed guns and ghost guns are sort of two potentially overlapping circles in a Venn diagram, right? Not all 3D printed, well, all 3D printed guns are theoretically ghost guns. Well, not
they don't have to be.
You could serialize
it and make it legally.
Right.
You can.
But there are also a large number of ghost guns that are not 3D printed.
So and you can buy an unserialized, unfinished lower receiver.
Yeah, you can basically buy a gun kit.
Yeah. And that's what they're trying to get under control.
Right.
And if you've got a task to perform and you want that task to be successful, you're likely to pick the tool to achieve that task right. that best meets your needs. I'm not so sure a plastic FDM 3D printed gun would do that. And those of us who've watched the vid of the murder itself, it wasn't point blank range.
Right.
And it was with what they're thinking of as a form of a silencer, both of which say that it needs accuracy.
They say the silencer was 3D printed as well.
They did?
Some sources are saying that.
Ooh.
So.
Wow. Well, it remains to be seen whether or not these really were 3D printed or were made via conventional subtractive manufacturing. We will find out in the near future.
Yeah. I think the issue here has really nothing to do with 3D printing, although a lot of the news seems to spin it as 3D printing is evil. It's the fact that we just really don't regulate guns in this country.
Unfortunately.
We don't effectively regulate guns, and that because of this sort of 80% loophole where you can buy, you know, an 80% completed lower receiver and all the other parts for the gun that you couldn't, make yourself very easily, and you can buy the lower receiver, or you can 3D print the lower receiver. It's not the part of the gun that receives the great stress of the bullet being fired. I mean, you buy a factory made, all the rest of the parts, basically. I'm not a big gun guy, but at least I understand that enough about it to understand that this is a firearms regulation issue, not a 3D printing one.
And unfortunately, a firearms-related issue becomes a firearms manufacturing-related issue, and that's going to be kind of tough. So what are you going to, make mills regulated? Are you going to regulate the design files?
You don't need to do any of that. You need to make the other parts of the gun regulated as well. So right now, there's of the, 30 parts that go together to make a gun, that I'm just spitballing that, I have no idea, but something in that range.
So start regulating the lower receivers.
No, the lower receivers are the only one that is regulated right now.
Oh, that's right.
And that's why you have to...
People make them anyway.
That's why you 3D print them, or you buy an 80% finished one.
How would regulation change that?
Well, you regulate the other parts of the gun as well.
But if they're getting the lower receivers anyway, even though they're regulated.
You're not gonna 3D print a barrel.
True.
You're not gonna
so regulate mill a barrel.
So regulate all of the other parts.
Yeah.
Because thing is, right now, it's like, I mean, a firearm is a very precise mechanical thing, right? And so they regulate one part of it, so you make your own, but the rest of it is you can just buy that off the shelf, right?
Why not regulate the bullets or the material that are in the bullets as well?
Well, that would be another option.
Why not regulate the whole thing?
That would be another option as well. But if you make it illegal to sell a partially assembled, partially finished firearm without considering it a firearm. I mean, sure, there's firearm regulations, but if you have to qualify to be able to buy a gun to
buy a
partially finished one, okay, that's fine.
But by doing it halfway, they leave a loophole.
Well, they leave a huge loophole that there's a whole industry that loves this and that's right. Taking advantage of it, and there's a whole industry.
And when you have a whole industry, that sure. Means money.
Right.
And when there's money, people get their opinions changed
sure.
While they get their wallets filled.
Right. Now, this is the first sort of high-profile shooting that we've seen done with a
yes.
Ghost gun. But there's been lots and lots of other ones that were just people that never made the media.
And I mean, it makes you wonder if...
There's thousands of these guns. Not all of them 3D printed. In fact, probably most of them not 3D printed.
Yeah, he could have done this. There, so. He could have done what he did without a ghost gun.
Well, sure. He could have done it with a legally obtained gun.
He could have. And that he used a ghost gun makes you wonder, why wasn't he more careful with his mask?
Mm-hmm.
He could have gotten away.
Oh,
he could theoretically have gotten away.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But we'll find out if this is a 3D printed gun or not in the near future. In the meantime, speaking of near future, what's coming up on our show this week?
Let's see. We're going to start out talking about deep mesh watermarking.
We'll be annealing HTPLA.
And we're going to say tariffs, anyone?
You think anybody will say, sure, I love them.
I can think of one guy.
I can think of one guy.
One guy, okay. So we're all kind of familiar with the notion of watermarking, right? That's sort of a concealed identifier. We have it in our currency. Most currencies do, or if you hold the currency up to light, you can see a sort of shadowed picture in the actual paper that the currency is printed.
It's very difficult. The purpose of that is at least it used to be very, very difficult to copy that watermark onto something that's not an official version of whatever that document is.
Right. So that's where the term watermark comes from originally. Now,
isn't it in the paper?
Yes.
And so that's why it's the water they make the mark by changing something of the water as the paper's being made or put water there.
Well, when you're doing it with paper, you have a something that's actually changing the thickness of the paper or changing the composition of the paper in a defined way. So that's where the term watermark comes from. Now, we've seen this in 2D versions of it. You can get plugins for Photoshop, in fact, maybe even native in the new versions, I don't know. But basically, the idea is to protect your image by encoding some kind of a identifier in it that can only be recovered by, holding up to the light, essentially. So you have to have some sort of a digital reader.
I've seen others. I've seen where there is something in the image that's blatant, like right across the image, there's some graphic watermark.
Oh, sure.
And then I've seen some where they make it so subtle that you have to zoom in like on the subject's eyeball right into the iris, and there's the watermark right there, because they don't want you to see it so that if you do use it, they can get you.
Right. Well, and the really subtle ones, you can't see it at all. It's encoded in the image in a way that is not visible but it's a pattern in that's superimposed on the data that makes up the image that a machine can, you know, there is an algorithm which can recover that layer of data out of the image, but that you or I looking at it can't. And that's like the really, you know, the really gotcha, you know, like, oh, wait, where did you get that image from? Mm-hmm. Right. So, right.
So obviously we're going somewhere with this.
Yeah. So that's
our 3D objects. If we can somehow have some form of like a watermark, then we can copy protect our 3D designs.
Right. So the general sort of requirement for this is to have something that is able to be embedded in an object, in this case an STL surface mesh, you know.
Yeah, but if you put it in the object, like for example, one of our favorite 3D artists, 3 Dizengoff,
uh-huh.
an Israeli artist who's done brilliant work, he attempted to put watermarks as an etching in the design of his works.
Right.
However, if you know how to use the tools, you can very easily remove them.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and the simple way to do it is you could just write your name, or Dizengoff could just write his name and write it in the mesh, but not and write it in the mesh in a flat area or a relatively smooth area,
right.
and not have any protrusion to it. And then unless you examined the mesh very carefully, you wouldn't notice that the name was actually written into the mesh.
It
was
you notice it if you watched it printing. You'd see it.
Well, probably not, because your toolpath would be agnostic to it, because it would just be part of. I mean, I could make a.
So you're saying it wouldn't draw lines of the name or an object, an image.
No, it wouldn't. It would be in the mesh. I could make a cube with our logo, for instance, or our names or whatever, flat. In the mesh, but as long as the cube, as long as that surface of it is planar like a cube, it will slice and it will print completely flat and planar like you would expect a cube to be. But unless you went in, pulled it into, Blender or something and went in and actually looked at the mesh, you would never notice that that data was actually encoded in the mesh, right? Mm-hmm. So it is possible to encode information in there, and that would actually be kind of the poor man's watermark. It would be relatively easy to detect, and it would be relatively easy to remove once you had detected it. What we really want, or what the people who are developing this really want, is a very robust system whereby you can't tell it's there unless you're looking for it, right? And you can't make it go away. You can't remove the mesh or remove whatever the watermark is.
So theoretically, it's an encoded watermark, not something that's visually obvious.
Right.
And the encoding fits within the digital version of your STL, your mesh file.
So you won't
it's zeros and ones.
Right. And you won't be altering the mesh. You will be altering the mesh, but not in any way that affects the shape of the object,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, we can take a cube, right? A cube could have one facet on a side, or it could have a million facets on a side, and it would still portray the same solid, right?
Now we're not talking about metadata. We're not talking about labels or things that are at the beginning or the end or in a specific location that you can find.
No.
We're talking about embedding zeros and ones within other zeros and ones.
Right.
And unless you know where to look and how to look, you don't know it's
right.
there.
So embedding a pattern within the mesh, but not altering the shape of the mesh, or not altering the shape of the object that's defined by the mesh, right?
Hmm.
So, interesting stuff. There's a couple of papers on it that are approaching a new version of it, where they're using what they call deep learning. So this is sort of an AI. Well, I don't know. My son would argue, he's studying AI, so he would argue with me as to whether this is AI or not. But basically, it's using a machine learning technique, right? Where you give it an input state and output state and say, get me to this, basically. And the way they're doing that is taking an object, and the one of the objects that they're using a lot is the good old Stanford Bunny.
Yeah.
that's sort of the classic. It's one of the early 3D scans, and they're using sort of various what they describe as attacks. So various ways that you could go about to defeat this watermark, right? So can you, will this watermark stay if you crop part of the image off, right? So if you take Stanford Bunny and cut one of his ears off, does the watermark still hold for the rest of it, right? If you scaled it, right? If you made it bigger or smaller, and then they're doing clever things like going in and adding a Gaussian blur. So basically taking a Gaussian algorithm and putting a sort of cloud of uncertainty around the location of each vertex and using that to essentially blur the object. And then by adding uncertainty, sort of randomizing the locations of the vertices on a small enough level that the macro scale of the object stays, visible.
Like create a noise level.
Yeah.
Within the data.
Yeah, basically can you use the noise a little bit.
Use the noise to make that little sequence of code unreachable or invisible, impossible to see or find.
Right, yeah. And then they're also going through and running like a Laplacian smoothing function, right? Which is sort of the opposite of blurring. And in fact, if sometimes with doing Photoshop work, you'll blur something and then smooth it again to sort of retain some of the highlights, but smooth out. It's kind of like airbrushing sort of. There's a lot of sort of the beauty filters sort of do that kind of thing. So, okay, so we can do this in 3D too. So they're coming up with all of these sort of different approaches, and then running this machine, deep learning algorithm to come up with a way of watermarking that can't be attacked by any of these. So anyways, interesting couple of articles if you're inclined to these sort of things. One thing that I noticed that they're not doing is they're not voxelating the object. And the problem with embedding data in these STL meshes is just because of, you think about it, this STL mesh allows you to, you can have a individual shaped object, right? So Stanford Bunny, and you could define an infinite number of meshes which would just as accurately or relatively, the curves and stuff, you would get some changes in, but on the macro scale, you could define essentially an infinite number of meshes which would define Stanford Bunny. Right?
Yeah.
So the problem is, how do you embed data in there in a way that redefining Stanford Bunny in a completely different mesh,
sure,
which is not that hard to do algorithmically,
no, it's not,
would then retain that
data? Yeah, you can
retain that
just
data.
Just load it up in 3D Coat.
Right.
Voxelate it.
Right.
And then remesh
it back into a mesh, and you have a mesh with a completely different topology.
There's no watermark.
And the fact, I'd be very curious as to if they had actually made a watermark that is robust enough to persist after that.
Or 3D print the bunny in the highest resolution as large as you can.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense for your 3D printer.
Uh-huh.
And then get yourself a good SLR camera and capture it with photogrammetry and print it again.
Well, yeah, you wouldn't even have to do that. You could actually take the object and turn it around. Take renderings of it and feed renderings into a photogrammetry software and reconstruct it that way. Because
there's no way the watermark
Watermark is not visible right. at that scale, right. so you're not going to be capturing it. So, it's interesting. Interesting questions as to, you know, just how to do this watermark in ways that would actually be robust. But I say right now, you could sneak watermarks in anywhere you want. And in fact, we may have one on the Thingiverse, because I remember I did years ago. A little, you remember it was like a set of pipes, kind of pipe fittings with water splash coming out of it.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that.
And I put our logo on the side of it, right? And then, you know, I put it up on the Thingiverse, and people are like, oh, that's great, but why'd you have to put your logo on it? I was like, well, because we're advertising our podcast, but... And so you know, people are like, oh, we want a version of it without the logo. So okay, so I just went and just flattened out the you know, basically, you know, grabbed the plane that was the raised letters, right? Where I think there were recessed letters. So just basically selected all those facets and just pulled them out till they were flat with the surface, right? And then they no longer print. You know, it now prints as a flat, smooth surface. But they're still there.
That's right. They are still there.
That if you look at the mesh, you can still find them, I bet.
But that doesn't serve the purpose of telling everyone, hey, go to our podcast.
True, it does not.
Let's talk about how to anneal HTPLA.
Okay.
Yeah. This will probably. I don't know if this applies to other annealing materials, because, in my experience, annealing PA6, I didn't have these kind of challenges. The PA6 seemed to stay in shape fairly well. I guess that's one of the advantages of going with PA6 is it's less difficult to retain your shape and your tolerances.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas HTPLA, you're taking it right to its transition point.
Right.
So it makes sense to not remove your supports. Keep your supports on, which can be a problem because after annealing, the supports don't break away nearly as easily. Uh-huh. And you'll have quite a bit more marring, and cleaning the marring is a lot more difficult. In the project that we talked about in the previous segment where I had this long screw, keeping that screw straight and the right size was the trick. It wasn't easy. And what I did was I took two pieces of flat wood and put them at right angles to each other. And when I pulled the part out of the boiling, it wasn't boiling water. It was just before boiling.
Yeah.
I took it out and I could see it was pliable. I put it into that right angle of the wood, which kept it everything straight.
As it cooled.
So those little tricks you're going to have to learn to do. And that's, unfortunately, there's no
That works set. For very simple geometry.
Right. There's no set way to do it. And that's the challenge of annealing.
Yep.
Your parts are going to move. You could easily lose tolerance. So you've got to find a way to retain the shape as it's softening. How you do that? Well, how do you anneal? There's lots of ways of annealing. Actually, three that I could think of. You use your oven,
mm-hmm.
which may not be a good thing to do if you're cooking food in that oven, because the material is going to come out of the gas will come out of that material. They put additives into these plastics beyond the basic formulation. There's no documentation of what they are. You don't want that in your body. I don't recommend doing that.
Yeah, I would recommend everybody who does that sort of thing have a utility toaster oven.
Something that you're never going to use for food again.
Yeah.
You could also use
good for drying filament too.
Yes, yes. You could also use a sous vide device. However, the sous vide device, you have to, I guess you don't have to put it in a vacuum bag. You could just drop it into the bath.
Yep.
And the sous vide water is never really going to get into contact with food. It shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just use an ordinary sous vide device like from Anova, they don't get as hot as some annealed materials need. So you're never going to get up to 90 C with a food-based sous vide device.
You know, 90 C is basically simmering.
Yeah. So the way to judge how hot to go, if you're just going to throw it in some boiling water, which is what I do, by the way, is get yourself a pot that you're never going to use for food again. Put the water in, turn it on, turn on the flame, and the moment you see fine bubbles kind of on the bottom of the pot, that's the temp you want. Turn the fire off, drop the part in. And you only have to wait maybe 5-10 minutes.
For a small cross-section
part. For a small part. The larger and thicker your part, the longer you should leave it in. However, the moment you take it out, you want to put it on something which will retain its shape. So either a flat surface or a right angle like I did for the screw. Complex designs, complex parts, this is where it becomes a challenge. You might be able to make yourself some form of jig that you can put the part onto. If the part's got to fit onto something, maybe have that something there. When you take it out of the bath, you put it on that. So it's going to be the right shape. But that's the thing to do. And also, after you've done that, you can take like a fan or something and cool it off as fast as you need to cool it off.
Or dip it in ice water.
Or dip it in ice water. But then if you dip it in ice water, you can't have it jigged. You can't have it held.
You could jig it and then dip the whole, dunk the whole thing.
Yeah, jig it first.
Run it under cold water.
Yeah, jig it first. But the thing about annealing is it's extremely context dependent, extremely use case dependent. The more you do it, the easier it'll be for you to figure it out ahead of time. It's kind of like, you know, almost everything in 3D printing. Experience is key. The more you print, the more things you print, the more different shapes you print, the more able you are to apply different settings and different things correctly. It's the same thing with annealing. The more you anneal, the better you're going to get at it. And I got to say, man, the strength of the annealed HTPLA, man, that's it makes it worthwhile.
Yeah.
It really does.
There's a really great article on Prusa's website about annealing 3D printed parts, and they do, you know, extensive, I mean, they do Sharpie test, you know, like the pendulum, you know, impact test, and they do all kinds of stuff on it. And very, very extensive, very, you know, well documented. And they're using not high temperature PLA, but just regular PLA, just regular off the shelf PLA. They're also doing it with PETG, ASA, and ABS as well.
But not all formulations are annealable. There are PLAs that are annealable that are not necessarily high temp PLA.
Yeah.
They become high temp once they're annealed. The only way you're going to find out is to try it. Test it yourself. But the stuff from Protopasta is the best PLA I've ever printed.
Good stuff.
Really, really good stuff. Okay, we're skating on thin ice here on this one. We're not going to take a side one way or another. We have our own opinions, but we're not going to be that kind of podcast, which is why our numbers aren't in the millions, probably. So the election has happened.
Yep.
And the side that won the election handedly, the individual who will be the leader of this country, the United, currently the United States of America, is stating explicitly that they are going to add tariffs to all imports. And this person has an individual that they work with, who's been involved with them for a while, a financial person, and they put out articles that state what the plan is. And the plan, according to those articles, which I am not going to reference, by the way, say all incoming imports 20%.
From everywhere.
From everywhere, including Mexico and Canada.
Okay.
But that's not really what this podcast is about. I mean, this segment. It's really about imports from China.
Right.
And they're stating at least a 60% import, possibly much more for electric vehicles.
Uh-huh.
Now, yeah. I don't want to get into that's right or wrong here.
Yep.
Because I don't want to go there. I let the other podcasters have fun with that.
Sure.
I want to only talk about 3D printing.
Yes.
However, this is definitely going to affect 3D printing.
Well, for sure.
Because just about all the critical components that have made desktop consumer-level 3D printing possible
mm-hmm.
come from China.
Right.
Which means the cost of our 3D printers are going to go up by at least 60%.
Well, sure. And it's like, I mean, we can have American-made printers, but an American-made printer, we're not going to have American-made. I mean, you want to price American-made stepper motors? You can get them. A single American-made stepper motor costs more than a Chinese-made 3D printer.
How much?
I mean, you're looking in the range of hundreds of dollars per stepper motor. I mean, we made stepper motors before the Chinese did.
I know,
but nobody
could afford to make them if you're just a hobbyist.
Right? Yeah. That. I mean, there were applications that used them. You know, back in the 70s and 80s.
That's why the big industrial machines like Stratasys mm-hmm. cost $50,000.
Sure, and even they're probably not using American-made stepper motors.
Not anymore. Not right. anymore.
I mean, why would you? The Chinese-made stepper motors are you know, almost 100% reliable for the applications that we're putting them through, assuming it's, you know, properly engineered, properly spec'd.
Mm-hmm.
You never have problems with your stepper motors.
But it's not just the stepper motors.
It's the linear guides, the linear bearings. Circuit boards.
The cabling, the connectors, uh-huh. the casings, the...
Yep.
The nozzles. There are some nozzles made in the U.S. and
sure.
there are some nozzles made in Europe.
Right, and a nozzle is a very easy thing to make compared
yes.
to any. It's the easiest thing to manufacture
yeah.
of any of those components of a 3D printer. You just need one machine to do that, and they're fairly common.
Now, one can easily argue, well, maybe it's about time. Maybe it's they've basically. Well, let's before we go there. Why are the Chinese parts so less expensive? Now, I'm going to give you what I've read.
Okay.
Because I think this is the reason.
Uh-huh.
The Chinese manufacturing are not... The Chinese businesses are not based on the same principles as those in the West and in the United States
mm-hmm.
and Australia. That is free market... 99% of the time, free market. I can't say that applies to automobiles and aerospace defense.
Sure.
But for commercial free market, it's you produce per what you believe your market will bear.
Right.
And you control pricing that way. So supply and demand are at a stasis, some form of homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the principles that these manufacturers go by. Instead, it's... Produce, and ignore market pressure, ignore market demand, just generate as much as you can
mm-hmm.
with the assumption, which sometimes is false, that when you flood the market with so much quantity, the supply will way outweigh demand and the price crashes, which puts your competition out of business.
Right, but also it puts you out of business if you are. I mean, you can't flood the market forever.
Right.
I mean, you can't. I mean, the big issue when this sort of first came to most people's minds was in I think the 1980s, 1990s.
Yeah, with
flat screens.
Flat screen. No, it was before that. It was electrical components. Uh-huh. We became aware of it. After that, it was flat screens.
They were dumping on the.
They were
the
dumping, and then it was solar panels. Was the next one. Now
yep.
it's electric vehicles that they're all worried about.
Yep.
And you know, perhaps those concerns are valid. I'm not going to argue one
sure.
way or the other, but the argument is, put a huge tariff on them,
uh-huh.
so that they're the equivalent price, and then people will purchase the locally made. Items, mm-hmm. And unfortunately, historically, that has not always turned out to be the case. And in the process, the pricing on things takes off.
Right. And there's no way you could make a 3D printer, an American-made 3D printer, where all of the components were sourced from America.
Right now, you cannot.
Well, you could, but you could never make it for anywhere approaching, you know, the even double or triple or probably quadruple the cost of what the Asian imported parts allow you to do, let alone, you know, the fully, you know, engineered printers.
Now, what we've seen historically is that this is a double-edged sword, because now the producers are trapped.
Yeah.
Because the moment they start raising their prices, the people that are buying up these parts stop buying completely. And right now they're at a point in their society where the demographic bomb has gone off for all of us and populations are starting to decrease. But in China, it's substantially more because of their own policies and for whatever reasons. Because of that, there's not as many people to do this production at such, and again, supply and demand, they're starting to demand more money. They've got a growing middle class. They've all got vehicles, electric vehicles, by the way.
Coastal China has become a relatively expensive place to live now. Central China is still cheap and relatively undeveloped.
So they can't afford to turn the spigot off to make the spigot more expensive. They can't afford to have it turned off because everything will completely fall apart.
Right.
So they're as trapped in this situation as we are. Yeah, but in terms of all of us,
I don't think they can lower their prices any way
to
absorb those tariffs, which apparently a large proportion of the voting public thought that was how it was going to work. No. But there's nowhere to go down in their, I mean, they've already stripped everything out of their market to get the price as low as they can. I don't think they can get them cheaper.
They can't. So what's the end result here? Well, probability is we're going to see price increases for literally everything related to 3D printing.
Well, for everything related to almost everything. So, think about it. I mean, if you go to the hospital, the machines you are hooked up to and all of the consumables that are used in those, 90% of that stuff is made in China now, or made somewhere overseas at least. So everything is going to become that much more expensive, which kind of sounds like inflation, right? When consumer prices go up.
But it's inflation for a different reason. It's not the same reasons as we had with the pandemic.
It's going to hurt just the same in the pocketbook.
It's going to hurt just the same. Oh, yeah. In any case, the bottom line here is if, you know, you're thinking about getting yourself a 3D printer or a bunch of filament, now's the time. Don't hold back.
Sure, you bet.
Yeah. Oh boy, Whitney, another show written to the hard drive, waiting for encoding, uploading, and commitment on our feed one last time for 2024. This will probably be our last show of the year. The feed will not go fallow, though. It will not go fallow. We're going to keep the show on the feed with previously posted shows from probably about 10 years back. I'm going to try to pick ones that are still relevant to what's going on in the community today. In any case, thank you all for your support for the past, 10 years. We're not quitting. We are coming back after the holidays. We're just taking off because we have our own things to do, just like you guys do. And also, usually this time of year, our numbers crash. Everybody's too busy to listen to podcasts, at least this podcast.
Yep.
So we are still coming back. We've still got a pile of content to give to you guys for nothing without ads. There's a potential of us getting a new machine next year. I'm not going to say what it is, but it will be featured and be one of our co-stars, and we'll be doing regular segments on it. And I know a substantial number of you guys out there have been wondering why we're not doing it. Let's see, we do have a thing of the week, and it's our annual Christmas ornament thing. This year, it was tricky to find a Christmas ornament on out there. First I want to thank somebody who is not getting the thing of the week. What's his handle?
Dazus. Yeah.
Dazus puts out ornaments which are potentially beautiful.
Has for the last couple of years he's put them out. This is Dazus, yes, otherwise known as Scott McClurg.
Unfortunately, Scott makes these ornaments with such extreme detail that most FDM printers will have trouble doing a clean print, particularly with silk PLA, which is what you really want to use to make these things really pop and be really pretty. So yeah. Unfortunately, I think we've had him once or twice in the past.
Yeah.
This year, we're going to pick a much easier ornament to print as our thing of the week for Christmas. It's the Christmas Balls Cross Ribbing from a Thingiverse user whose handle is JLL8. Jalate, do you see him there? You were looking at the article and not doing this. You were not doing your job.
Looking at the news article, sorry.
Oh my gosh. Jacob Lattenberg out of Chechnya.
Oh, cool.
His handle is JLL8. Jalate.
Yeah.
Cool. Anyway, he's done a whole bunch of ornaments, but we picked the Christmas Balls Cross Ribbing because with the right materials, you'll get this nice, smooth finish on the outside and really take advantage of that rainbow silk that you just got from Black Friday. Let's see. If you're interested in checking them out, go to, let's take you to the specific one. There's commercials popping up, guys. Sorry. Christmas Balls Cross Ribbing is thing number 6859051. And if you click on Jill 8's handle, you'll get to see all the other forms of ornaments that he's made. These look like they would be much easier to print. I'll be printing mine with full contact support rafts underneath, but these would print fine if you split them in half and printed them middle up and then bond the two halves together.
Mm-hmm.
Should work really good, no problem. Let's see, if you've got a tip, a question, or a candidate thing of the week, what are you waiting for? Send us an email.
Send it to info@3dprintingtoday.com. That's THREE, followed by the letter D, followed by printingtoday.com.
And again, as always, I'd like to invite all of our listeners to our free forum on Google Groups. Just go to Google and type in 3D printing tips and tricks. When you get there, if you want to, you don't have to post if you don't want to, but if you want to take part and post, you got to give Google an email that associates you with that post, and you have to hit that little join group button. I always recommend not to use the email address that you typically use for all of your personal stuff. Instead, I recommend making yourself a Gmail account for free and doing all your interactions through that Gmail account. That's the best way to go. And this way, if they ever scrape the emails from Google, you won't be getting more spam than you really should be getting. Not that anybody should be getting any spam.
I'm going to say if they do or when they do.
When they do. Yeah, when they right. do. We're not going to do coming attractions because, well, I guess we can say we've still got a nice pile of segments to talk about, such as the anti-polymer zeitgeist that's happening out there, combining objects and Prusa slicer, hard versus flexible build plates, troubleshooting Petchy, and we've got a long list of them. I'm not sure which ones we're going to use for our first show of 2025.
That'll be next year.
It'll be next year. Yeah. And I'm not sure which show we're going to repeat. That's going to be a surprise.
It'll be a classic episode.
I hope so.
All right.
Or it could be a classically bad episode.
Well, there
no,
you go.
No. I don't put on bad episodes. Okay.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the old episodes are sort of sliding off the back of the feed. And
yeah.
you still have them, but they're not available anywhere on the internet.
And a lot of the stuff we did is still relevant, surprisingly, after 10 years.
Yeah.
It's still interesting, relevant stuff.
Yep.
So I guess that's it. Again, if you guys want to contact us and say Happy New Year or whatever, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love seeing new people coming on the forum. So if you're up to it, try it out. You'll have fun.
All right. So happy holidays, and thanks for listening.
Happy New Year, everyone.